KBEV 16 breaking news. It's been another big day in Falcon Valley, folks. I'm Melissa O'Hare for KBEV Colorado. I'm outside the police station, and sources inside tell me that just hours after Nicholas McGuire, the assistant athletic director at Falcon Academy, passed away at Colorado Mountain Hospital, police not only have a person of interest, but have already made an arrest. This is pretty shocking news, given that most of the community had assumed that Mr. McGuire, a distinguished athlete in his own right, as well as an administrator and coach who was admired by students, parents, and teachers, had been gravely injured in an accident in the school gym. Officials are not naming the suspect at this point, but I've learned from inside sources that this terrible crime could all come down to one of the oldest motives in the world: jealousy. 41. Dr. Leonard Romano, the prosecuting attorney, had a PhD in law from some 40 years earlier and was half blind, so his report was printed in oversized font. Small and wiry, with close-trimmed steel-gray hair, he wore a suit with a bow tie, as he did every weekday except casual Fridays, when he ditched the button-down look for a collared shirt tucked into grandpa jeans.
"I take it suicide has already been ruled out?" he asked.
"Mostly," Ken answered. "He had several guns at home, which would have been an easier way out. We doubt he purposely threw himself backwards against a sharp object with the intention of puncturing the base of his skull before then jumping over a balcony."
"Uh-huh. And no defense wounds?"
"No."
"And the girl? What was under her fingernails?"
"Not his skin. Plus, she's barely 100 pounds. Nevertheless,
this is an unusual case," he said to Ken and Beth over sandwiches and coffees at his desk. "My, my, my." He touched his glasses, as was his habit. "Natalie Bellman, what a piece of work, eh? Relationship to the victim, ex-girlfriend, fingerprints in the blood on his phone." He looked up at Ken and Beth. "Very damning."
Ken nodded, and Dr. Romano went on in his gravelly voice.
"Surveillance footage showing her going in and out of the gym 2 times the afternoon of the alleged incident. Last person in the building. Search warrants uncovered victim's blood on a skirt hidden under her sink, and a message on her brother's phone in which she stated, 'I did something bad.' She also stole drugs from students and had the dead man's tie stuffed in her desk drawer."
Dr. Romano looked up again.
"Not looking good for this young woman, is it?"
Beth said, "Well, just wait." Dr. Romano touched his glasses again.
"These excerpts are from her diary?"
"It was more like an exercise log and planner," Beth said, "with the occasional short summary of how things were going in her life."
"I see. Fits of rage, paranoia, jealousy, and thoughts of self-harm and harming others."
He leaned back in his reclining office chair and put his hands behind his head.
"Frankly, detectives, I'm surprised you characterize this as a humdinger. This seems more like a slam dunk."
Beth turned the page of her copy of the report and said, "At first, keep going and see what you think."
"You've got some doubts about this, Detective Larson?"
"Actually, Doctor," Ken said, tapping his own report, "we both do. You've just read everything that we knew right before we arrested her, but as we consider going forward and making formal charges, there's more to the story."
"Talk to me," Dr. Romano said.
"Beth, would you like to go first?" Ken asked.
"Sure," she answered. "So, it turns out Mr. McGuire was a bit of an enigma."
"How so?"
"Well, he had alcohol in his system at the time he sustained his injuries, which is not unusual in general, but he'd been working with children all day long. Also, lab results have come back on a monster energy drink can that had his fingerprints and DNA, as well as trace amounts of the drug GHB.
I'm old. Refresh me about the drugs these young people are doing."
Reading from her notes, Beth said, "GHB is a drug that was originally popular with athletes as a growth hormone, but was outlawed in the early 90s. It then emerged as a club drug and a date rape drug. People who take it say that it's an intense aphrodisiac."
Depending on the dose, GHB can cause mild feelings of increased libido and euphoria, all the way across the board to intense hallucinations and seizures. Medical vials in Mr. McGuire's locker were found to contain GHB and ketamine, which is another club drug. Ketamine is a dissociative sedative more often referred to as Special K. At one time, it was used as an anesthetic during surgeries on people. Eventually, it was mostly discontinued for human use. It's still considered safe and inexpensive to use on animals, so it's not that hard to get. There are plenty of these drugs here in Falcon Valley. GHB and ketamine are both Schedule 3 controlled substances.
And he had these in his locker?
Dr. Romano asked.
Tsk, tsk. You never know about people. Go on.
Miss Bellman at first denied ever seeing Mr. McGuire on that Sunday afternoon, but after her arrest and a number of interviews, she revealed that she'd been afraid to tell us the truth, that she had been in the gym that evening, and that she had seen Mr. McGuire, but that she thought he was dead. Her story was that she picked up his phone to call for help, saw that it was broken, wasn't thinking clearly, panicked, and decided to leave the body, unaware that he was still capable of being saved.
Dr. Romano said. I don't know about that. Didn't she have her own phone? No one goes anywhere without their phone anymore, do they?
She lost it the night before, at a school function, Beth replied.
Oh, yeah?
Dr. Romano laughed.
Well, that's convenient. We thought the same thing, Ken said, until we spoke to a student who confirms she dropped her phone that night and he picked it up. He didn't return it to her right away. We've had a look at the phone since, and there's no suspicious activity on it.
Dr. Romano shrugged.
All right, then. That's a bit of a surprise.
Miss Bellman was eventually bailed out by the law firm Klein and Carroll, Ken went on. We continued to investigate with the hope of bringing formal charges, but the more we learned, the more complicated it seemed.
Ken looked at Beth and said,
Sorry, Beth, please continue.
Beth turned the page of her report. Per CCTV footage, Sloan Elliman Holt arrived for a private training session with Mr. McGuire at 3:59 p.m. Natalie Bellman went into the gym at 4:08 p.m. Sloan says she saw Miss Bellman sitting in the stairwell when she went to the bathroom at about a quarter after. Mr. McGuire was alive and well at that time. Miss Bellman then left a few minutes later, as per CCTV. The next two people to enter were Asha Wilson and Brooke Elliman. Brooke is Sloan's mom. She and her friend, Asha, went to pick Sloan up from her training session a little bit early to go out to dinner. According to both women, they arrived to find Mr. McGuire seemingly intoxicated and alarmingly aggressive. They said he was stumbling and acting in a way they found frightening.
Dr. Romano interlaced his hands and nodded.
Beth read out loud from the report. Mr. McGuire's behavior was so upsetting and unusual that the two women decided it would be best to leave. Together with Sloan, they exited the mezzanine, walked down the stairs, and turned down the hallway that led to the exit. At that point in time, Mrs. Elliman said that she heard a sound like a splat from inside the gym. Mrs. Wilson said that she heard something also, but to her, it sounded more like a thump. She thought perhaps Mr. McGuire had thrown a gym mat or a medicine ball over the balcony. Neither one of them wanted to stay in the pavilion any longer because of Mr. McGuire's scary and threatening behavior, so they proceeded to leave without looking into the gym. In retrospect, Wilson and Elliman believe the sound they heard was Mr. McGuire either jumping or falling and landing on the basketball court.
You're kidding,
Dr. Romano said.
No, that's their statement.
Ken moved to the edge of his seat.
If we take these women at their word, then their version of events corroborates Miss Bellman's story that she went in about 30 minutes later, at which point she picked up his phone to call for help, realized it was broken, and came to the conclusion that he was deceased. And if that's the truth, then the only thing she did wrong was walk away without calling later to report what she'd seen.
Dr. Romano typed something into his computer and spun back to the detectives.
I keep expecting it to change, but we're still a no-duty-to-rescue state. Even though we probably shouldn't be, given all the people that keep ending up at the bottom of cliffs while out for a hike with spouses who don't call for help.
Beth nodded. Agreed, but we are a no-duty-to-rescue state,
and even the failure to render aid misdemeanor only applies if you're a medic or in a special relationship with the injured, such as a parent, spouse, or employer.
A couple of the things to consider, Ken said. A third Falcon mom by the name of Linda Leland came forward later to say that she had to go to the sports pavilion mezzanine much earlier in the day to pay Mr. McGuire for her son's private training sessions. Ken paused. These private training sessions seem to be a cash-only kind of thing, if you get my drift.
Christ, Dr. Romano wiped his forehead with a handkerchief. I pay my lawful taxes. Am I the only one doing it by the books?
Not the only one, Ken said, smiling and indicating Beth. She's very honest, too.
Beth laughed, but inaudibly.
So, this Linda Leland lady, Ken went on, she claims that Mr. McGuire appeared to be impaired and acting irrationally as early as noon on the day he took the big dive.
This guy seems like a real gem, huh?
Dr. Romano said.
And this woman is credible, too?
I mean, Beth said. Yeah, kind of a rich hippie, prominent member of the community. I can't see any reason why not. Had a DUI 15 years ago, but that's it. No record.
And lastly, Ken said, we spoke with Mr. McGuire's former girlfriend. She's a Canadian actress by the name of Amélie Bernard.
I've heard of her, Dr. Romano said. She was famous. He was dating her?
Yes, Beth said. But they had long since broken up. Miss Bernard told us that despite the fact Mr. McGuire had been telling everyone around here that they were in a long-distance relationship, she'd called it quits with him almost 2 years ago. The final straw was when he had a seizure in a nightclub in Toronto after taking too much GHB.
Dr. Romano looked disgusted and said,
I'm not sure I need to hear anymore. I'm thinking this guy took some of these drugs he kept in his locker while he was supposed to be working with kids and got loopy and then, let's see, you say here he had an injury to the back of his head. Okay, so he was lurching around up there on the balcony area, fell and hit the back of his head on this weightlifting equipment thingy that's mentioned here with the blood, tissue, and hair. At that point, he fell over a railing and suffered some terrible internal injuries that led to his death.
That's certainly one of the possibilities we're looking at, Ken said.
Well then, Dr. Romano said, you can be sure that's going to be the defender's case, and it's a good one. I don't think jurors are going to think this was a nice, innocent guy.
Beth cleared her throat. No, that's for sure. Plus, we're in the process of rebuilding his phone and getting search warrants for the home computer that was put in storage after his death. I've got to be honest, it's looking like the tip of the iceberg with this man. Not a nice, innocent guy at all.
What are we going to do? Charge this young woman?
Dr. Romano flipped through some papers.
Who moved to Falcon Valley to look after her disabled brother, was a stellar employee at a top-notch school, no criminal record whatsoever until she stole some pills out of the lost and found, and whose story is corroborated by three other women?
He flipped through more pages of the report.
The blood on her clothes, here we are. She said she wiped the phone off so she could use it to call for help, only to realize it was broken. The call to her brother, I did something bad. She was ashamed that she panicked and left. No DNA under her nails and no offensive or defensive wounds. Nothing in this report indicates that all these ladies are lying.
Ken nodded.
Well, Natalie did change her story about why she had his tie hidden in her desk a couple of times. I think she was embarrassed about snatching a little souvenir from their relationship.
Dr. Romano closed the report definitively.
I think Natalie Bellman was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and I think that pursuing this case would only make us look like idiots. My opinion is that this man's debauched lifestyle led to death by misadventure, and despite the fact that you say he was a beloved faculty member at Falcon Academy, my hunch is that he won't be missed.
Several months later. 42. It was a cold Saturday morning in February, and Natalie was at the Olive Diner, having breakfast with Jay and Yvonne, who were officially dating. Natalie wasn't eating much, not because of any pills. She was done with those. She was just nervous. In an hour and a half, she had an appointment to meet with Beth and Ken, again at the Falcon Valley police station.
It's going to be okay,
Jay said, scooping up some hash browns on his fork.
I know, Natalie answered. I think so, anyway. I've got butterflies, but that's normal, right?
Totally, Yvonne said. I still get nervous buying booze. You've got nothing to worry about, girlfriend.
Jay gave Yvonne a closed-lip smile as he chewed on his potatoes, and she smiled back while sipping on her Bloody Mary. They were happy. Natalie hoped Yvonne was right. Since the district prosecutor had declined to press charges, she'd kept a low profile. Though she'd been prepared to crawl across broken glass to keep her job, Mr. Dilly had said,
Of course you can't come back. An inappropriate relationship, drugs, lies, stealing, an arrest for God's sake.
In the ensuing few months, Natalie had considered moving back to Denver, but decided that was a last resort. She joined Care.com as a dog walker and started driving for Instacart. Lately, she'd been painting for hours every night. Mostly, she stayed at home, and if she did go out, she avoided places where she might run into Brooke or Asha. She knew now that the story they'd told the officers had likely saved her from a lengthy trial and probably jail. But she felt it was best to keep her distance. It didn't seem like it was safe to come out yet. She checked her phone. It was nearly noon.
I better go, guys, she said to Yvonne and Jay, reaching for her wallet.
I've got it, Nat, Jay said.
He'd just started back at his old job at Adrenaline Extreme Sports, this time in sales rather than leading bike and jeep tours.
Good luck,
he said. By the entrance, as she was leaving, Natalie said, Rex? The big man was hunched over a bowl of berries, yogurt, and granola in the window by the door, reading the newspaper. Natalie smiled sheepishly.
Hey.
Hey,
he said back.
I was just, she gestured back into the diner, having breakfast with Yvonne. It's nice to see you. How are things at the school?
I don't work there anymore, he said, wiping his mouth and putting the napkin back down on his lap. Yvonne didn't tell you?
No, Natalie sat down in the chair opposite him. Since when?
Not long.
What happened? I mean, I know we weren't really friends, but still.
It's okay, Rex said. We weren't friends. We didn't even know each other. I didn't know much about you, and you didn't know much about me. For example, you didn't know I used to be in the military police.
We barely talked.
That was me. I didn't want to talk to people. I wanted a nice, quiet job where I didn't have to get to know anybody. And then Dilly totally messed up what happened with that girl Sloan, interviewed all the accused boys before the victim, and then completely ignored mandatory revelation laws. I know about the laws. Christ, he should be in jail. I was very unhappy when he fired you.
I thought you hated me. You gave me some dirty looks there at the end.
I did, Rex said. Some dirty looks like, why did you get involved with that jerk? I thought you were smarter than that.
Natalie nodded, looking troubled.
Yeah, I should have been. I'm sorry you lost your job.
Rex plunged his spoon into his yogurt.
Who said I lost my job? I didn't lose my job. I quit. I'm half Arapaho, and I'm working at the Black Swift Casino and getting the salad buffet every day, twice a day. Good for my diabetes. Don't worry about me. Take care of yourself.
I will. Thank you, Rex.
Natalie hadn't been back to the Falcon Valley police station since she'd been arrested and detained in a featureless and empty holding cell equipped with two cameras, an old-fashioned wall phone, a water fountain, and a stainless steel toilet in the corner. Today, she was led to a small room in the back where Beth and Ken were waiting for her.
Hi, Natalie, Ken said. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too, Detective Bradley. Detective Larson.
You look very well, Beth said. Healthy. Natalie took a seat.
I'm doing better. Thank you for noticing.
Beth placed a bottle of water on the table.
So, Natalie said, pulling the water bottle closer and beginning to toy with a paper label. What's this meeting all about?
Beth opened a manila folder.
We wanted to follow up with you about what we've been doing these past few months.
We've completely rebuilt Mr. McGuire's phone, Ken said, which takes a while and doesn't always work, but we got lucky.
This is tricky, Natalie, Beth said. We can't tell you everything. There are minors involved.
Natalie crossed her legs nervously and waited.
Clearly, Beth went on, I know a lot about what went on between you and Mr. McGuire from reading your planner.
This made Natalie incredibly uncomfortable.
Let's talk for a minute about the drugs, Beth said.
Do we have to? Natalie asked, and Beth and Ken both laughed, which was strangely comforting.
Yes, we do, Ken said. But you're not in any more trouble. Just relax and answer truthfully. First of all, have you gotten help for your addiction? Because if not, we have resources we'd like to extend.
Thank you, Natalie said, examining her nails as if she'd love to chew on them. She folded her fingers into fists. But I stopped. Nick was dead. I lost my job. I spent some time in jail. I no longer had access to the pills from school, and my brother took all the painkillers that he hadn't used over the past year to some sort of safe prescription drop-off place, and I was just, there was nothing. I was never that person who had a phone number to call to go meet someone on the corner of, you know, First and Vine or anything. I went to some group therapy meetings at the Unity Church in Blackswift. It helped, but I really had no choice but to stop. I don't mean to make it look easy, but I did. I just stopped.
That's impressive, Natalie, Beth said. Not a lot of people can do that. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you some personal questions related to your, she smiled encouragingly, past addiction.
Natalie took several quick breaths and said, I'm ready.
Correct me if anything I say isn't right. Mr. McGuire initially supplied you with amphetamines, Beth consulted her notes, which you eventually began to take often.
Yes, that's true. He provided me with a leftover bottle of Adderall that his previous girlfriend, Amelie Bernard, had left at his home during a prior visit.
Ms. Bernard claims those pills were never prescribed to her, Beth said. You didn't see her name on the bottle, did you?
I never looked. No, that's incorrect. I did look, but there was no name. It was ripped off. I thought that was, you know, for privacy, because she was famous. And rich and skinny and perfect looking, all reasons why it made sense to take the same pills that she took.
Those pills were acquired by various other means, not by lawful prescription.
Oh, I just, okay.
Also, you occasionally took opioids that had been prescribed to your brother, which it appears you'd been using for some time to self-medicate a history of periodic depression.
Depression?
That was my interpretation. Was I wrong?
Natalie thought about it for the first time ever.
No, I don't think you were wrong. And is there anything else you took, drug-wise? It's important we know.
Edibles, Natalie answered. Nick and I ate marijuana edibles every once in a while. They were legal, bought at the dispensary.
But you didn't ever take GHB or ketamine?
No, I've heard about them, Natalie said, but never been offered, never been interested.
They're club drugs, Ken said.
I know what they are, she said, but we didn't go to clubs. Nick and I didn't even go out to restaurants. We barely went anywhere.
I understand, Ken said. Let me put it another way. Do you think it's possible that you might have been given either of those drugs?
What do you mean? Without my knowledge?
That is what I mean, yes, Ken clarified. Usually GHB is diluted in a beverage. It looks like water and has almost no taste. Ketamine is a tranquilizer and can be taken in a variety of ways, one of which is by injection.
What exactly do these drugs do to you?
They might make you feel good and relaxed, and then again, they might knock you out, make you go to sleep. Is it possible you might have ingested either of those without knowing during your time with Mr. McGuire?
Natalie looked away, thinking. Did he have those drugs?
Yes, Ken said, nodding.
The two detectives waited while Natalie unscrewed the top of her bottle of water and took a drink. When she set the bottle down on the table, she answered, It's possible. Beth made a note of this and looked at Natalie with a very grave expression.
We found pornography on Mr. McGuire's phone and computer,
He had some chat room acquaintances around the country that helped us piece together the events of last spring. Mr. McGuire was hoping to obtain some illegal photos of a certain underage girl via her boyfriend, but that fell through, and it was very frustrating for him given that he was in a state of pathological sexual anticipation. At that point, it appears he resorted to more extreme measures to get what he wanted. While quite a few of the images we found on his computer originated elsewhere, even in other countries, there are several dozen that appear to have been taken in a location that would indicate he himself personally took the photos.
The training room, Natalie said, closing her eyes.
What makes you say that? Beth asked.
Just a bad feeling, she said, even though she knew it was the truth. I'm right, aren't I?
Beth declined to confirm, but went on to say, we think that Mr. McGuire drugged two girls in order to photograph them. We know that the trainer routinely administered anti-inflammatory shots to some athletes. We also know that on two occasions, the trainer wasn't available, and Mr. McGuire administered injections to female athletes on his own.
Is he allowed to do that?
No, but we understand why a predator would go to all this trouble. First of all, the ultimate motive behind getting these types of photos is not just sexual gratification, but also coercion, blackmailing the girls to get them to do what he wanted. We think this is probably where Mr. McGuire was going, but he never made it to the finish line, so to speak. Second, why the injections? There are no more overnight tournaments in hotels, at least not with a male coach and a girls' team, so we believe Mr. McGuire had to get creative. He was never alone with anyone except for his private training sessions, and they were an hour to 3 hours at the most. That's not enough time to dose a person with GHB or Rohypnol. It takes too long to get those date rape drugs out of the system and recover.
So then, what was he giving these girls? Natalie asked.
He used ketamine, Beth said, injected it right into their hips. He was able to find something that took effect almost immediately and lasted a very brief amount of time. Ketamine is often snorted recreationally, but in that case, it enters the body more slowly. Only by injecting it can you get an instantaneous reaction. It's a knockout drug that causes confusion, not knowing who you are or where you are.
Natalie thought back to all the times she'd spent hours upon hours passed out in Nick's dark bedroom.
There had been the time when she'd woken with a sore hip. She'd originally attributed it to a pulled muscle from their bike ride, but had later noticed it was bruised a greenish blue. That hip had been tender off and on all summer until they'd stopped seeing each other, and then the bruise had finally gone away. And then there was the morning she'd woken to find that her clothes were in the dryer. Why? Because she'd had an accident that she couldn't remember. There were so many missing moments over the past 6 months. Not blackouts exactly, but deep sleeping. And she'd blamed herself, thinking she'd worked out too hard, or was exhausted after being too amped on the Adderall, or had taken one too many painkillers, or that she shouldn't have had that second margarita.
Are you all right, Natalie? Ken asked.
She nodded, and at that point, Beth continued. Mr. McGuire administered the victims a very precise amount of ketamine, enough to knock them out for 5 to 10 minutes. When the victim woke up, it wouldn't necessarily feel like they'd been drugged. Ketamine would make them groggy. It might have seemed like seconds had passed, like maybe they'd fallen asleep. Beth glanced quickly at Ken, and he returned her look with a subtle nod. It's likely, Beth said, uncomfortably fiddling with the corner of one of her papers. It's likely that it was a challenge for him to get just the right dose for his... She took a deep breath and looked up into Natalie's eyes. His agenda. Nick's last voice message had said,
I don't require your services anymore.
Natalie thought maybe she finally understood. She could barely believe what she was about to ask.
Was he experimenting on me?
Ken lowered his eyes, but Beth nodded, her face pinched in a solemn way that indicated she was either furious or sorrowful, or both. It's not just possible, Natalie. After reading your planner, it appears that Mr. McGuire had a very unusual interest with your weight. Giving you drugs to make you thinner, taking them away when you got too small, giving them back when you started gaining again, not interested in seeing you when you weren't the right size.
I found it both puzzling and suspect that he wanted you to be exactly 108 pounds.
Natalie waited, and Beth seemed to be trying to decide whether to say more.
Tell me, Natalie said. Tell me what you're thinking.
108 pounds is the median weight between the two miners who were drugged, Beth said gently. One was 106 pounds, the other 110. I know this is hard to hear, it's hard to even imagine. But yes, we believe Mr. McGuire was fine-tuning the toxicity of his injections by using you. He was meticulous in determining how much was just enough and how much was too much. The lengths he went to make sure he had just the right dose, are criminal and obsessive. To that end, he needed you to weigh roughly the same amount as his 15-year-old victims.
Natalie understood then, like a slap in the face, that he'd chosen her. That day in the forest, in the middle of their hike, sitting by the lake with Jackson. It had been meaningful for her, but theater for him. She'd told him that she'd been hurt by someone in the past.
But I don't want you to think that I'm some wounded and broken person. I'm not. I'm good. I've got a little baggage, but...
He'd answered, shh, that's not what I was thinking at all. In fact, the actual thought that was going through my mind was, she's perfect.
A perfect target. During their initial flirtation, Nick had said to her,
what are you, about 5'4"?
Precisely, she'd answered, feeling playful. He'd been sizing her up. Not even one day of their relationship had been real. Not one. 43. It crossed Natalie's mind as she drove away from the police station that she could go straight to Jay's. It would have beer in the fridge, and though there would be no Vicodin in the bathroom, she could always smoke a bowl or eat an indica dark chocolate sea salt edible and zone out on his couch watching something mindless and funny. She didn't have to be alone, going over and over the horrendous details of what had happened to her and those girls. Those girls, she said out loud. That wasn't the extent of it, not by a long shot. It was also Reed who'd listened to a powerful middle-aged mentor and done what he was told to do. It was Reed's friends, all punished, all tainted, families ruined, a school scandalized. An entire town, obsessed with wealth, prestige, and winning, had been easily poisoned by a slick salesman who promised them everything they desired, at the cost of the kids. Natalie wasn't going to let him poison her anymore. She was going to rise above it. It was difficult, but when she came to the turn that would lead her to Jay's house and the relief of beer and weed, she went the other way. Maybe later, when she wasn't hanging by a thread. At home, she tried to stay busy. She made herself a bowl of ramen because it was the closest thing she had to comfort food in the apartment. After slurping up the last of the noodles, she put the dish in the sink and admitted that she couldn't keep from thinking about it forever. She went into her bathroom, turned on the faucet, and splashed her face with cold water. Don't blame yourself, she said to her reflection. But who was she kidding? There was no way around it. She'd gotten involved with him. She'd seen warning signs and wanted to ignore them. As if checking her own pulse, her fingers went to her tattoo. But the words, self-love, didn't help. She'd allowed herself to be used in the worst way possible. Natalie selected a medium-sized, fresh canvas and took it to the workstation in the corner of the kitchen. As she began to paint, she tried to think of happier times. Selling her first painting on Etsy, getting a $200 tip from the big party at the rooftop bar at Le Meridien, laughing so hard she choked on her pizza with Jay, her mom and dad dancing like teenagers to electronic music after Thanksgiving dinner, while she and Jay jumped on the couch the year before Dad packed a bag and left, saying, see you next week. Beth had said that she'd been self-medicating for depression. That was Natalie's first diagnosis, and it was the first time that she'd ever considered it, but she supposed it was true. Real joy had been missing from her life for a while after her dad left, and then later after the blackout at the party. There had been ups and downs, of course, good times and bad, but she had gotten used to there being something missing. Nick had come along and his attention had filled the void. "Idiot," she said out loud, using a sponge to rub light gray paint onto her canvas to create a background the color of a snowstorm. Her plan was to paint her own footsteps across the parking lot the night she'd found him, an image that she couldn't shake from her mind. "You might have been stupid," she thought, "but you weren't the only one." Amelie Bernard had fallen for Nick, and she was a celebrity. Brooke Elliman had hoped to date him, and she could have had any man she wanted. Elena Ruiz was not only beautiful, but an intelligent doctor, and she'd been cheating on her husband with Nick. Natalie stopped there with that thought. Elena. She did not fit the profile. Nick sleeping with Elena suddenly didn't ring true. For the first time, Natalie realized, I got it wrong. Nick wanted girls, not women. Nick hunted girls, not women. He used women to get to girls. Natalie went to the sink and began rinsing out a paintbrush. Watching the water pour, rubbing the bristles between her fingers, she allowed her mind to wander. He'd drugged her. He drugged Mia and Sloane while he was training them. Jill Ruiz had died shortly after being trained by him. Nick drove Mia home that night. Natalie had assumed he'd gone to Elena's house afterward to sleep with her, but he must have taken Mia there. Why had he taken Mia to Elena's house? To Jill's room, where Natalie had found his tie bunched on the floor. Because he'd been obsessed with Jill Ruiz, as obsessed as he had been with Sloane and Mia, but Jill had been his first. The first, the most important, the one he couldn't forget. Suddenly, Natalie understood what Beth had said about his experimentations. Meticulous. Just the right amount. Not too much, not too little. He needed a guinea pig this time around because he didn't want to make another mistake. He'd given Jill the wrong dose. Maybe too much, maybe too little. Either way, she'd woken at the wrong moment, ran, and jumped in her car. A 16-year-old, brand new driver with drugs in her system, trying to get the hell away from a monster, ending in her untimely death. Your wings were ready, but my heart was not. Yet another family he destroyed. Nick had clearly been unhappy with the result of that experimentation and had decided to do better next time. Natalie put down her paint sponge, grabbed her car keys, and headed for the door. The doctor and her husband had put their house up for sale, but Natalie thought there was a good chance that they'd stayed in the area and that Elena would still be working at the hospital. As she drove towards Colorado Medical, she tried to organize her thoughts. If she was going to have this conversation, she needed to be prepared. Natalie told the nurse at the front desk of the maternity ward that she was looking for Dr. Ruiz. Is she your obstetrician? The woman asked pleasantly. Placing one hand on her stomach, Natalie said, Yes. It was easy to confirm that Dr. Ruiz was still on staff. I don't suppose she'd be here right now by any chance, she asked. No, I'm afraid not, the woman answered. Thank you anyway. As Natalie left, the woman called after her. She's scheduled for tonight, though. If you come back in an hour, you might be able to grab a quick word before she goes into surgery. That's great, Natalie said, waving. I appreciate it. Natalie went to her car to grab her stocking cap, a pair of gloves, and a scarf. There was no reason to go home and come back, and the last thing she wanted to do was miss Elena by waiting in her car. Once she was bundled up, she went and sat on the bench situated outside the revolving doors, leading into the wing that housed the maternity ward. There was a staggered parade of evening shift nurses between 7 and 7:30, and then no one at all entered the building for the next 15 minutes. Natalie knew it was Elena when she saw her across the parking lot because the woman was so statuesque. She was dressed all in black, coat, boots, and cap, and she walked with purpose as if she were an intrepid assassin. Which, Natalie thought, was exactly what she was. Intercepting her before she crossed the street to the front entrance, Natalie said, Dr. Ruiz, could I have a word with you? Elena hesitated. Natalie loosened the scarf around her face, hoping to be recognized. The doctor squinted, and it seemed for a second that she had placed Natalie as the young woman from the hospital room.
I'm afraid I can't talk right now, she answered. I'm very sorry, I've got an induction in an hour.
This will only take 5 minutes, Natalie replied.
I'll give you my card. You can leave a message with my nurse.
On her black cap was an embroidered black flower. Her face was like a Modigliani painting, doe-eyed, classic, lined from sadness.
Okay, Natalie said. So I should just tell your nurse that I want to discuss Nicholas McGuire with you?
Elena stopped digging around in her purse for a calling card and looked at Natalie more carefully.
It's you, isn't it? She asked. The girl who was in his room?
Natalie nodded and said her suspicion aloud.
And you were the doctor standing there behind me when the lights came back on?
Come with me, Elena said. Let's go sit in my car.
She led Natalie to a nondescript gray Volvo and used her key fob to open the doors.
Please, she said, motioning for Natalie to climb in on the other side.
Once they were seated, Elena took off her hat and laid it in her lap.
What can I do for you?
She asked, looking extremely tired.
I saw the two of you together once, in a store, Natalie said hesitantly. He was holding you, and you were touching his face. I thought you were having an affair with him.
I wasn't, Elena answered, and it was clear that even the thought was unpleasant.
I know that now. I figured it out about 2 hours ago.
Good then, Elena said briskly. And with that out of the way, can I go see my patient?
I mean, Natalie said, I've got it all figured out.
It was so swift that Natalie barely caught it, but alarm rippled across Elena's face. Composure replaced it, and she said,
Really? At such a young age? I've never had it all figured out, but if you think you're there, I'm sincerely happy for you and wish you all the best.
He spoke to me that night. He wasn't succumbing to his injuries. He was waking up. He was getting better.
Elena looked at Natalie as if trying to read her mind.
Have you told anyone else about what you saw?
No.
Is this about money? I don't have anything to hide, but neither do I want any problems. I don't have anyone to leave my money to anymore, so if that's what you want, I really don't care. Just make me an offer. What will it take to just leave me and my husband alone?
I'm so sorry, Natalie said. I gave you the wrong impression. I don't want money.
Then what do you want?
To understand. To know going forward. Rather than wondering every single day if any of it really happened the way I remembered it, if I talked to him, if I imagined it, if I made it up in my head what he did to them, all of them, if I'm crazy.
You're not crazy, Elena immediately looked away and said. I mean, you don't seem crazy.
Did you hear us talking that night? Natalie asked. Did you?
Elena shook her head.
Talking about what?
You were there, Natalie said. Asha, Brooke, and I, we were all in her room, and I remember the conversation we were having. I said something like, I know that he was doing the private training sessions with your daughters and that he did bad things, like giving them something to make them sleep and taking photos of them. And then I turned around, and you were there, standing in the room listening to us.
Asha was my patient. I had a reason to be there.
Did you have a reason to be down in Nick's room in the ICU 20 minutes later?
I can ask you the same question.
I was thinking about killing him. What were you doing there?
Elena sat quietly for a moment, her dark eyes huge and calculating. Eventually, she sighed.
Yes, okay. I heard the three of you talking when I came to Asha's hospital room that night. I understood that Mr. McGuire had drugged those two girls during a private training session. That was all I needed to know. He was training my daughter the afternoon she died. My daughter wasn't perfect, but we had a good relationship. Mr. McGuire told me that against his wishes, she left her training session early to go meet some friends. Jill died in a car crash shortly after that. I never could find these friends that she'd made plans to meet. It wasn't Reed Leland, I checked. He was at a family get-together in Vail. It bothered me ever since, but after listening to you three talk, I asked myself this question. Why did my daughter leave her training session early, get in her car, and start racing home?
Because he did something to her.
Yes, that was my conclusion.
How did you do it?
Do what?
Natalie said. I know what happened, You killed the man that abused your daughter and caused her death. I know it. I'd just love to know how.
I don't admit to anything you're accusing me of. But if I was going to do something to Mr. McGuire, hypothetically speaking, to make him slip back into an unresponsive state just as he was emerging, I would have simply given him a shot of potassium chloride.
That simple?
The coroner did an autopsy and found that Mr. McGuire's cause of death was vasospasm, an inexplicable narrowing of the coronary artery. Basically a heart attack. Organ failure after terrible trauma.
Caused by a shot of potassium chloride?
No one will ever be able to determine that, unfortunately. Potassium chloride is naturally present in the body, and the level becomes elevated after death. There wouldn't even be any cause for suspicion or further investigation. Unless, Elena paused and looked up at the roof of the car, vulnerable for the first time. Unless, for example, someone came forward to say that he was getting better rather than worse, that he was awake and talking rather than slipping away. That would be a problem. That would be a big problem. For me and what's left of my family.
I'm not a problem, Natalie said. I'll never tell anyone I spoke to him. And I'm so sorry.
About my daughter?
Yes.
Thank you, Elena said. Me too. But let's be clear, I'm not sorry about anything else.
I understand, Natalie said. And in that, you're not alone.
44. Summer had announced its arrival. Jay had started to accompany Natalie on the first quarter mile of Rocky's walks, still dependent on his cane. At that point, Jay would head back for home, and Natalie would take the dog another mile or so before turning around. She was just starting on her way back to Jay's house when she got the text message from Asha.
It's been such a long time, Natalie. I would really like to talk. Can you please stop by the open house I'm having this weekend? I've attached information.
I really would love to see you.
Natalie opened the attachment. The open house was actually an apartment. She recognized the address. It was Brooke Elliman's pied-à-terre that she'd bought for her now ex-husband, in the hopes that her generosity and civility would help lure him back to their home and marriage. The apartment had been empty for ages, except as a party pad for wayward teenagers. Who had open houses for apartments? The invitation was questionable, to say the least. Then again, Natalie had started questioning everything after learning that her relationship with Nick was fake. Despite the fact that she had eventually been released without being charged in Nick's death, Natalie would never, ever stop thinking about one thing. Asha, Brooke, and Elena had killed him. She felt complicit for what she'd done to his phone, of course. Asha and Brooke didn't know about Elena, and Elena didn't know about what had happened in the gym. At the end of the day, only one person knew it all. Her. How long would those women go on living their lives, wondering if she was ever going to tell anyone about their role in his death? Natalie did, in fact, have a passport now. She debated meeting Asha at Brooke's open house apartment. It felt weird, and she wasn't sure she could trust them. But in the end, she decided to go.
I'll be there, she texted back to Asha. I'm looking forward to seeing you.
When the weekend arrived, Natalie drove into town and across the river to the mountain slope opposite where she and Jay lived. The Koi Creek apartments were modern and minimalist, with a soothing waterfall and small koi pond in the lobby. Natalie buzzed the 9th floor, and an elevator arrived to take her up. It opened directly into the open plan loft, decorated in the same theme as the lobby down below. Expensive, but characterless. No fish, lots of stainless steel, white leather, and black accents. Asha was a little plump, half a year post-pregnancy, but still very cute and quicker on her feet. She came running over.
Thank you for coming, Natalie.
Natalie was reluctant to step out of the elevator. Something wasn't right.
I know it's a little weird, Asha said. I'll explain.
Brooke emerged from the kitchen. Come here, she said, holding her arms out for a hug. Natalie's eyes dropped to the floor of the apartment. She half expected to see a plastic tarp so that they could kill her, wrap her up, and get rid of her body without a mess. She said,
I shouldn't have come. I'm sorry. I think I might just go.
Don't be silly, Asha motioned for her to step out of the elevator.
It's okay. I didn't tell you it wasn't a real open house and that Brooke was going to be here because I wasn't sure you would have come.
I might not have.
Why does this feel like a trap?
Shh, Brooke shook her head. You've got the wrong idea. Just come in already.
Natalie finally relented and stepped out of the elevator and into the apartment.
What do you think of this place? Asha asked. It's dazzling, right?
It is, Natalie said automatically and without looking around.
I'm still confused as to why I'm here.
You seem mad. Why are you mad at us, Natalie? Brooke asked. We made up that story about him falling so they couldn't do anything to you. I would have thought you'd be happy.
Natalie crossed her arms over her chest.
I am, but it's also hard to forget you walking by me in the police station, acting like I was garbage right before they arrested me. I thought you'd thrown me under the bus. You still could. I have some trust issues.
That was just an act for the police, so they didn't think we were in cahoots, Brooke said.
Whatever you say, Natalie answered. For her, every bit of it still stung.
Someone laughed in the other room, and Natalie looked spooked.
Just Mia and Sloane, Asha said. Ever since everything that happened, they've been sort of inseparable. Brooke and I like to keep them close. They're in the bedroom watching a movie.
Are they, Natalie searched for the right words,
doing well?
They're doing better than they were before, Asha answered. Now that Mr. McGuire's not riling them up about colleges, pitting them against one another, and trying to exert so much control over them, they've both been more relaxed and happier. They're getting along great.
Asha paused and glanced toward the bedroom door. Under her breath, she said,
We don't talk about him with them. Not yet.
No more issues about UCLA between us, Brooke said. Mia wants to stay in state for college so she can see her baby sister more, and Sloane has decided she doesn't want to go to UCLA anyway because she doesn't want to spend her life in my shadow.
Brooke threw her hands up.
And I, whatever, that's fine. I'm over it. I'm proud of her for wanting to do her own thing.
Excellent update, Natalie said.
Yeah, so follow me, Brooke said.
She led them over to the sliding glass door that opened onto a stupendous balcony. Asha followed, and they all gathered overlooking the 9-story drop to the ground.
Natalie suddenly pictured the two of them pushing her over it, just like they'd done with Nick. She took a step back, away from them. No matter how much they smiled, touched her arm, and threw their heads back laughing like they were lifelong close friends instead of conspirators, Natalie knew what was going through their minds.
Only one person knows what we did. This chain is only as strong as its weakest link.
I do want to thank you both, Natalie said, grabbing onto the steel railing, for telling the police that you heard him fall. They believed it, and here we are. Otherwise, I think I'd be, well, pretty much screwed.
That was the least we could do, Asha said.
Linda helped us too, Brooke said. She lied for us. She knew what Nick was all about.
But does she know what really happened? Natalie asked, hoping there were no other loose ends.
Asha shook her head.
No, nobody does, except the three of us.
Not even the girls? Natalie asked.
No,
Asha said. Mia's got the bad memory of the intervention. She knows that someone took photos of her when she was unconscious, but she doesn't know who. She thinks it could have happened at one of the kids' parties.
And Sloane says Coach Nick never did anything to her. No recollection of any of it.
Are you going to tell them the truth? Natalie asked.
Of course, Asha said. But we're working with their therapist to figure out when is the right time to do it.
Natalie glanced towards the bedroom. The girls were laughing again. It must have been a comedy.
They can still be troubled by what happened, even if they can't remember and haven't been told.
Brooke nodded.
We know, and we know what happened to you when you were their age, and that you understand better than anyone what they might be going through. Their therapist is the best in the area.
Natalie, Asha said, this therapist, She's available to see you, too.
Oh, Natalie said, waving her hand. Now that Mr. Dilly fired me, I don't have any health insurance for the time being. But I'm happy for your daughters. I think they'll be okay.
We'd like to pay for it, Natalie. Scratch that. We are paying for you to go and see the same therapist as Mia and Sloan.
Brooke looked as if she was ready for Natalie to challenge her.
It's happening.
I couldn't.
Yes, you could, Asha cut in forcefully. Just say yes, please. We owe you. Natalie looked at each of them, and they seemed to genuinely want her to accept.
Okay.
Thank you. Do you mean it?
We mean it, Asha said. And I was wondering.
The breeze was kicking in, and Asha had to brush her hair out of her eyes.
Now that I want to spend most of my time with Tara, is she here? I'd love to see her, Natalie said.
Phil's looking after her at home. He's been surprisingly excited about being a new dad. And you'll get to meet her. She's a handful.
As I was saying, though, now that I want to work less, I was thinking I could use an assistant.
That makes sense.
She's asking you if you'd be interested, Brooke said.
Someone to help me stage, who actually has an artistic sensibility. Someone who understands composition, color, and lines, and not just pine cones in a bowl that you saw on Pinterest.
I could teach you, and you could help me, and maybe eventually I could guide you through getting your real estate license.
Natalie was silent for a second.
I would love that.
When Asha told me she was thinking of offering you a job, I had an idea too, Brooke said. I was wondering if you might be willing to help me out.
In what way?
This is the apartment I bought for my husband when we separated. It's dusty. Someone needs to water the plants and, I don't know, all that stuff that most people do, like change filters and light bulbs and shit. I need someone to look after the place.
Natalie cleared her throat.
Oh, me?
Would you be interested?
Like, for how long?
For as long as you want.
Natalie thought about it, looking around at the apartment that had probably cost at least $1 million.
What would my rent be?
Brooke considered this.
What if we said you were the housekeeper and I didn't ask you for rent?
Natalie felt a lump in her throat.
I've been looking into adopting a cat. Could I have a cat here?
Yes, done deal then, Brooke said.
Come to the kitchen, Asha said. I have a tradition. We always drink champagne when we pass on a property to a new tenant.
She went and grabbed a bottle from the fridge and opened it with an expert twist and pop. Brooke placed the keys to the apartment on the counter in front of Natalie, raised her glass and said,
One of us needs to say it. Here's to getting away with it. Here's to Asha for figuring out what was going on. Here's to me for that amazing right hook. Here's to you, Natalie, for stomping on his phone, because if you hadn't done it, he would have called for help, lived, and Asha and I would probably be in jail. And here's to Linda, who decided to back us up and say that he was a drunk loser by noon on the day he dived over the railing. Cheers.
Natalie clinked her glass against theirs, thinking about Elena and Jill. At some point, she thought, when any threat to Elena was long past, she would go see her and tell her the whole story.
You know what? Brooke asked. I like this. Next Saturday, let's do this at my house. Brunch at 11? Asha, you bring the baby. Natalie, you can bring bagels from the bakery. And I'll make a lox platter and mimosas. What do you say?
Natalie smiled.
I guess I'm in.
Epilogue. KBEV 16 Breaking News.
Melissa O'Hare here. Stunning developments in Falcon Valley in the case of the deceased Nicholas McGuire, a minor celebrity in the sports world and once a much-loved coach at the Falcon Academy private school. Startling allegations about his abuse of student athletes are trending on social media and being covered by all major news channels. There's new information that has drawn national attention to the soccer sleazebag who appears to have been using drugs to sedate and abuse girls under the guise of physical therapy. It turns out that Mr. McGuire now has accusers stepping forward from Arizona, California, Texas, and Illinois, which has, as you can imagine, warranted the interest of the FBI. In light of this new information, the Denver Major Crimes Division has decided to reopen the investigation into the soccer sleazebag death last October. According to lead detective Ken Bradley, they now believe the coach had a number of potential enemies who likely wished him harm. Should be interesting. Stay safe, Colorado. We've got a storm coming in. This is Terry Schnaubelt. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Lying Club by Annie Ward, presented by Park Row Books and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Jennifer Lopes. Text copyright 2022 by Annie Ward. Production copyright 2022 by Harlequin Enterprises Limited. Used under license with Harlequin Books SA. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.